you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us this month to talk about famous first edition C28, I can't even tell, my eyes are so old. Famous first edition Detective Comics number 27 is our pal and returning guest. I was going to say the Perry White to my Lois Lane, but more appropriately, I would say, because you're my boss, Dan, over at 13 Days, I would say more appropriately, you're the whatever the editor is of the Gotham Gazette to my Vicky Vale, Dan Greenfield. Hi, Dan. Welcome back.
Hello, Rob. Thank you so much for having me. It's been too long, and I am really glad to be here.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been a little while. And I will tell you, I just mentioned this to you off air. For anyone who hasn't heard me mention this on other shows, I will be relocating very shortly. And this podcast we are doing, Dan, is the last one I am recording as a resident of New Jersey, which is, of course, where Gotham City is located. So it all ties together.
Yes, it does. And I grew up in New Jersey, so it feels full circle. And I am greatly appreciative of the honor.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about, as I said, famous first edition, the Detective Comics number 27, full-size Treasury sized reprint. We've covered some other of the famous first editions on the show before, but amazingly, we have not gotten to this seminal book, Detective Comics number 27. Before we talk about this, Dan, like, what is your history with the famous first edition? Did you have this one as a kid? Did you have any of them as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, we did, and I think we did Batman number one together, I want to say.
I think we did, yeah.
I think we did. I did not have Detective Comics as a kid. And the reason was because, for the same reason as a kid that I always preferred Batman to Detective, is that Batman was multiple Batman stories, and Detective was one Batman story.
Right.
And I would read, you know, at the time, nothing really was all that interesting to me about Detective Comics other than that story, which I read and had reprinted in books and whatever. So I never really felt compelled to get it as a kid. But, you know, you get older and you have a little bit more in the way of resources, and the completist in me would not allow me to not purchase it, because it's such a gorgeous edition of the comic. I didn't get this one until I was an adult.
Are you saying that Bruce Nelson as a feature didn't really excite you as a child? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, it did, you know, No, I can say that it did not. It did not. It was and in reading it, you know, actually last night in preparing for this was the first time I actually read the comic cover to cover. Hmm. I'd paged through it. I'd read, of course, Case of the Chemical Syndicate a million times over.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, but I'd never actually taken the time to read every story. And it was an experience.
Yes, that's one way of putting it. Yeah, we'll talk about all these features. I think some will end up talking about a little more than others, but yes. But we'll see. Yeah, one of the things I can say about these famous first editions, and maybe we talked about this when we did Batman number one, I honestly did not go back and listen to it, was when I was a kid and I was buying like price guides, right, and I was learning about comics history.
Oh yeah,
I always lumped Action number one and Detective 27 together, obviously, because they are the twin pillars of which the DC universe is built. First Superman, mm-hmm. First Batman, and DC often mention them together. But when they did the famous first editions and they roped in Wiz Comics and Batman number one and Sensation number one, it expanded the pantheon. You know, it, like, all of a sudden in my mind, oh, there are half a dozen or 8 or 9 seminal titles that started the DCU, Flash Comics number one, that started the DCU, and they're all now together in one big group. So the group got expanded just because DC was like, hey, these books deserve this deluxe treatment. And as a kid that loved this format, that meant a lot to me. It was like, ooh, they put them in these silver or gold or bronze inked covers. Like, this was really important. And so that it all of a sudden the DC universe just by this, it got bigger for me because I'm like, oh, it's not just these two books. It's like these 8 or 9 books. And that's where it all spread out from.
Yeah. What I like about them is the sense of, I love the cover design is very simple,
yep,
but I love its sense of grandeur. It makes you feel like you are, and you're right about the gold coloring or the silver coloring or whatever that they use for each particular edition, because they're subtitled too, like Limited Collector's Silver Mint Series, like that. And then, and with Action Number One, I think it's Gold Mint Series. And one of the others is Bronze, you know, but then the rest, I think they just are what they are. But what I really like the scope of these, you know, I like the logo. So the presentation really does make a difference. And I'm not just talking about the size. It's just, here is something special, kid. Here's not just a story. Here is an event. And here is something that you could learn and you can enjoy. And, you know, just recently when we did particular Famous First Edition came out 50 years ago this month. So we actually are hitting a couple of anniversaries, Batman's 85th anniversary, and this particular edition's 50th anniversary. And the we did our Bronze Age Bonanza where we look at all the covers of the month and rank them just for shits and giggles. And I put this one on the list, even though it's, you know, it's Detective 27. It really doesn't belong on the list. It's a reprinted cover. But I put it there because of that sense of majesty. Mm-hmm. For lack of a better term. So I right off from the cover. And then, of course, you can't beat, the whole, you open it up. And of course, that gigantic Detective Comics 27 in all its color glory. Mm-hmm. Just that it's almost like Wizard of Oz, where you start with, you know, this here's this kind of staid presentation. Then you open it up and your eyes are blown out by the color. And that's great. It's the kind of thing I think that I wish I had taken a plunge on as a kid, but that's okay because I get to enjoy it now.
Yeah, of course these Famous First Editions are the only treasuries that actually reprinted the covers. Yeah. You know, that was famous. I'm always complaining on the show. Why didn't they just reprint the covers in between the stories? Why do they save it for a little postage stamp size cover gallery on these? But here it's like, no, you see this cover in its full glory. By the way, it has never occurred to me. I've been looking at this cover for what, 50 years? How long I've been reading comics? It has never occurred to me that this cover, this famous cover, is the most thoroughly unmysterious cover you could practically get, because it's the brightest yellow background.
I know.
Like, it's not at night. It's not. No. It's like, I never thought of it until I looked at it and said, geez, Batman is flying around in broad daylight in front of these two crooks. It's kind of amazing. Yeah,
it looks like a July afternoon.
Yeah. It's hot in Gotham City. Oh my God.
Yes.
Now before we get to the book itself, I do want to mention the inside cover. There's a little article by then publisher Carmen Infantino, and he just gives kind of a little bit of a history of everything. But I found it interesting that in light of, you know, later battles, Bill Finger is mentioned pretty prominently in the, you know, it's like our Infantino just dodges giving him full co-creator credit, but he's mentioned enough that I could almost imagine that might have rankled Bob Kane a little bit, because he's really pretty, he's more prominent than I would have guessed.
Well, it was under, and if memory serves me right, we covered in Batman number one, there's a Finger died in 74. Yep. And Batman number one came out later in the year. And there is another piece by Carmine, or maybe it was actually written by Paul Levitz and given to Carmine, I don't know. But it gives full credit to it basically says, without using the exact words, everything you love about Batman is because of Bill Finger, not because of Bob Kane. And it's a pretty striking column. This walks up to that line.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true, because he refers, I think he Justin, yeah, he refers to Kane creating the character, basically combining these various elements. But it's Bill Finger who authored the first story and was responsible for many of the innovations made in the story. So it is great that there is that acknowledgement. And you know, as we get started even looking at the first story, well, I'll wait till we look at the first story. So.
Okay. Yeah. Like I said, everybody, don't worry. We are not going to get this deep into, we're going to talk about Batman a lot, but we're not going to spend as much time talking about Plainclothes Pete or the aforementioned Bruce Nelson, because obviously some of these strips deserve a little more examination on there. So anyway, of course, so the first Batman story, you know, the Batman in quotes. Now, for anyone who, even if you're a major Batman fan, not necessarily everybody has read this story, even though it's been reprinted many times. And, you know, I've read it a bunch of times, but it's been a while since I've actually sat and read this original piece. I always kind of have to remember that this is not an origin story. While this is Batman's first appearance, Batman is already Batman. It's not, you know, we will learn that in another story. And it's kind of funny. I have to remember, oh yeah, that's right, we just start the relationships are already in place. Commissioner Gordon knows who Batman is. He's already got, it's all, he's got the car, not, he doesn't, not the car, but he's got a car. I mean, there's a lot of this stuff already here, but there is no origin story. It's just, hey, he's Batman.
I actually like that, because it is a little bit different, and it you know, when you read, first off, I like the trivia of the first Batman supporting character is Commissioner Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
He predates them all. And in the very first panel, that's not the Banner, it's Bruce Wayne and Commissioner Gordon talking. And I just like that little part of it, because it's been that way. And Gordon has since become this, you know, character of his own in terms of like being this beloved feature and featured character in Batman. So I like that we get to see the Commissioner here in a very nice tweed outfit, which could not have been easy to draw. But yeah, I like the fact that it's mysterious. Now, if you're, I don't know how old you would be typically, it's 1939, you're probably 8 to 10 years old, maybe 12. And the one thing that strikes me about the story is, like, is it clear to the reader from the jump that this guy, Bruce Wayne, is Batman? Because when I read the story, of course, I knew that already going in. But that's why I like the fact that it's not an origin story. It's actually a mystery within the mystery story, that this Batman character is this mysterious character who dresses up like a bat, and we don't know why, and he shows up and he looks really cool, and we don't even find out, you know, literally that it's Bruce Wayne until the very end of the story. And I just think it's a very creative way of approaching and introducing a character and having like a twist at the end, as opposed to, you know, starting off what we got in Batman number one, which was basically a reprint of what we saw six issues from now in Detective 33.
Yeah, that's true. You know what? It's funny. I hadn't really thought about that. And then actually, when you read it, it's really not until the very end that Batman, the character of Batman, even speaks. He doesn't speak until basically the next to last page where he's apprehending the villain. But he's mostly just this silent, just silent, weird guy. I did find it interesting, too, that in the very first panel, you've got that silhouette of Batman in front of the moon with his cape extended. And so right then and there, like, they've already started to get the iconography down. You know, they've already realized that that's a very powerful image. And in fact, it kind of appears again in another one of the stories, oddly enough. But this idea of a bat shape in front of a lit background is incredibly powerful. I mean, really, one of the most iconic, maybe even you could argue, depending of how you feel about Superman versus Batman, the most iconic superhero symbol of all time. And so right from panel one, Kane and Finger kind of had it figured out, like, ooh, this is really cool looking.
Yeah, no, I exactly what you just said. It's like from that very, here he is on a rooftop on a moonlit night, and there he is in silhouette. And it's, you know, we don't even have the bat signal yet, but there it is right in front of us. And it is the like using the scallops, even in the first caption, and just they were playing with it right now. Again, how much of this was Kane and how much of this was Finger, I don't really know. But nevertheless, regardless, it is really effective. And I love seeing stuff like that. I mean, you love seeing the changes, but you also love seeing that what worked right from the beginning. What worked right from the beginning is that Batman concept. Bruce Wayne and who he himself has changed over the years in terms of his personality, but this is when he was still a bored playboy. You have Commissioner Gordon, and you have Batman being this silent avenger of the night and is really good at what he does. So, he doesn't even have the gadgets yet. He doesn't have a Batcave. There's no Wayne Manor. But nevertheless, the basics are all right in front of you, and they stand up to today.
I mean, God, I mean, they've even done Elseworld stories where they tie Batman back to this look, you know, where they, I mean, he's got the no, he's got gloves, right? They're kind of like purplish
The
gloves.
purple, like, yeah, just purple gloves, plain purple gloves.
And then
And there's.
I love when he's driving the car and there's like the, we see that the ears actually don't even extend out over the cowl in some panels,
Right.
which makes him look kind of like he looks very un-Batman-like without the pointy ears. The minute you remove that little detail, you're like, all right, that does, that's not Batman.
Yeah. I think he looks eerier too, with the bat ears out to the side as opposed to being on top. It's definitely creepier. And of course they're using it right now. There's a three-part miniseries written by Dan Jurgens and illustrated by Mike Perkins, called The Batman First Night. And they use the hyphenated Batman, and it's a three-issue Black Label series where it basically takes place in 1939, but written from a very modern perspective. I recommend it based on the first issue alone. Of course, there are two more to go. But in what you're saying, it's like it's if Batman. It's a weird thing to say that if Batman comics existed in 1939, this might be what they were like. Well, we know what they were like in 1939, but it's this revisionist concept that is actually quite effective because it plays with a lot of the same tropes that you see in this very story.
There you go. I'm sure that when, you know, DC was going to reprint this, they were probably wished there'd been a little more Batman in this 64-page book as opposed to just these
Probably.
6 pages. But, you know, what can you do? You know, this is the way it
Yeah.
was at the time.
I would be curious as to how it did sell comparatively. I mean, it sells itself in the sense that it is the first Batman story. But as we were saying earlier, Batman number one to me is one of the greatest comic books ever. Not just Golden Age. It holds up today as a great read. It's got four great Batman stories, a lot of fun stuff inside. But it's the full package, and at the same price at the time, which is a dollar, which wow. And what I also appreciate about the story, particularly in comparing it with most of the other stories in the issue, is that Bill Finger could write. We think of him not just as someone who tells stories in terms of like Batman stories, and he invented all this stuff. This is a very tight, basic. Not fairly simplistic, but still solid whodunit. And you are led along to believe, who it's likely to be, but you're not really sure until it plays out. And it's it of the of all of the stories in the issue, it's the most, I don't want to, I complex might be overstating it, but it's the most detailed of all of the stories. So you not only get this really interesting character, and busting heads and throwing guys off roofs and what have you, but you're getting a good story that goes along with it. So when you read it like that, and especially when you compare it to the other stories in the book, it's like no wonder he was a star from the get-go. A great look, a great concept, and a really good story to start it off with, and it fits the detective mold. It's a whodunit that he has to solve, but it's got all sorts of weird. Very 1930s horror elements, it's yeah, no, it's a winner.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, I'd love how gleefully Batman dispatches the bad guy because he punches the guy. And then the bad guy falls into the vat of acid, and
Yes.
Batman says, "A fitting end for his kind."
Yeah, he has. Yeah, there's no. He's just like, yeah, whatever. I mean,
Like,
he's not packing heat. But he's falling into the acid tank. Ah, a fitting end for his kind. And then
the guy.
even the, however can I thank you? Why? Gone. That whole Batman disappearing while someone's talking to him trope, right there in the
Right
first
there,
story.
yeah, right there in the first
Right
story.
there. And I also, and then at the end, I also like Bruce Wayne returns home to his room. Like, what does he live in, a boarding house? And his room, a little later, his door slowly opens and reveals a document. If the commissioner could see his young friend now, he'd be amazed to learn that he is the Batman. Watch for a new thrilling Batman story next month. And I again, I don't know if you're reading it as a kid, was that obvious or not? It's impossible to read it any other way. But I also like, and just as a quick side note, the thing about this story is that it has been remade several times over, over the years as an anniversary shtick, first in 1969 and then later in Detective 627. They gave the same basic story over to different writers and artists and say, okay, what can you come up with?
Oh, that's
And my
fun. I didn't know
favorite,
that.
yeah, it, Batman 380 or Detective 387, I want to say. And Mike Friedrich wrote it, and it's Bob Brown art and Joe Giella inks. And it's basically what's great about that one, it's essentially the same story and the same setup and the same payoff, except or close, except that the kid, instead of kind of being a milquetoast, he's an angry, rebellious hippie. And so there's this conflict. Yeah, no, it's great. And it's this, and he's like, he doesn't trust Batman because Batman's the man. And what's what right,
It's right there
right, exactly. He does, and Robin, meanwhile, is the square law and order. And so Robin and the son like have this like ongoing battle, like they're yelling at each other, Batman's trying to rein Robin in, mad dogging it, and he's Batman's like, chill out a little bit there, Robin. And Robin's all like, law and order, man, law and order, and how can we trust his kind? So it's very 1969 in that regard, and that the payoff at the ending, and this isn't a spoiler, I mean, I guess it is, but the story's been out for 55 years. I'm going to spoil it
It's
anyway.
okay, everybody.
You're right. It ends the way you would expect it to end, but the last panel has Batman sort of kind of chiding Robin about jumping to conclusions, and the lesson that we should learn is that maybe we should listen to each other, as opposed to just make these assumptions. And it has a split panel of the son and Robin, and both of them are sharing the same word balloon that says, "Man, I've got some heavy thinking to do." So, I mean, right. It's great. I reread it recently, and it's so much fun. And then they did it later on. Jim Aparo and Marv Wolfman and Jim Aparo did a version of it, and Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle, and I'm sure there's others too. But it's interesting to see this material, this basic material, and how you're still able to translate it for today, and that's lasting power.
Yeah, that is really cool. One thing I would love to know, I guess somebody's written about this at some point, but I'm just not familiar with it, is like if you go back and you look at the first, say, two dozen covers of Action Comics, Superman is not on every one of them, right? He's not on like number two or number four or seven. And you can if you go to Mike's Amazing World, which again is still an amazing resource, perfectly amazing resource. You go back and you look at all the covers, you can see Superman obviously as the letters came in and the sales picked up, and they realized, okay, Superman is the thing selling this book. That eventually Superman becomes the cover feature and he never loses it for the next 1,000 issues. But in the first two dozen, he's going back and forth. And it's the same thing with Detective. Like, Batman is on the cover of number 27, but he's not on the cover of 28. Now it's mentioned,
Sales
it
numbers
says,
hadn't come in yet.
right, hadn't come in yet. Now it says you can get Batman in this book, but he's on the cover of 29, and then he's not 30, and then he's on 31, not 32, then he's on 33, not on 34, although he's got his head on there, and then he's on 35, 36, and he's basically, that's it. At that point, he's on every cover. And he realized, obviously, the sales had picked up, the letters had come in, they knew, okay, this is the thing that's selling this book.
And like in the same way with Superman, they figured out after along that period of time, this guy's not only just the thing selling this book, but he deserves a book of his own. So,
So,
it was a quarterly at first, of course, but and detect, and that's the funny thing is that Detective, which never broke format for decades. I mean, it wasn't until the 70s where it started to stray away from the idea that because there was all through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and I think late 60s is when they started, because after Robin left for, well, that was around that time, Batgirl became a backup feature, or Robin became a backup feature. But prior to that, it was Elongated Man. It
Martian
was
Manhunter, yeah.
Martian Manhunter, most famously through much of the Silver Age. And then before that, there's, like Powwow Smith,
Roy
other.
Raymond, TV detective,
Yeah,
yeah, a lot
right,
of stuff.
exactly. So there was, it always held to that. And it was until, I think, the 70s, I think it was a monthly throughout all that time. And Batman didn't become a monthly, I think, until the 70s, which is really weird to think about. And
Yeah.
then it started to flip. Then it was like, okay, now Batman is going to be the monthly, and Detective kind of took a back seat. And that's sort of where we're at now. Although now they're both monthlies.
I remember back when I was, running the Aquaman Shrine, and I was actively sort of doing the history of tracking Aquaman, every appearance that he made. And, after he left Adventure, he bounced from book to book to book. He went to World's Finest. And there were like seven issues where he was a backup and detective. And even as an Aquaman fan, I'm like, oh, come on. Now, he's
There's
not.
also Hawkman was a backup too for like a couple. I was like, Hawkman?
Yeah, now
And it
come
was
on,
the
guys.
winged, they referred to it as the winged detective. I'm like,
The
not
detective of
really.
the seas, Aquaman. No, now stop it. Now, come on, DC. Even I have to admit that's really stretching it. So, okay. So as I said, there are other strips to mention. We're gonna kind of just breeze through these because again, there's not honest, not a whole lot to say about them. There's a little more than some others. The next one is Speed Saunders. It's by Fred Gaudinier, and he's Ace Investigator, and it's got the Killers of Kurdistan. And look, it's not fair to judge this stuff with an 85-year,
No, it's
lens.
not.
It's just not. It's this is it's fine. I
Yeah,
would not say it's actively bad. It's just fine. Visually pretty dull. It's a lot of heads talking in
yes.
very giant balloons. But it was fine.
All right. I'm gonna address the elephant in the room so that we can just get it out of the way.
Hey.
There is some seriously racist stuff in this
Yes, there
comic book,
is. Yes, there is.
and we and speaking for myself, I acknowledge it. It's unacceptable, but it is indeed of its time. So you do have to. I'm able to put aside my own very strong feelings about such things. For the sake of art in it, in the context in which it was created. So when you look at a story like this, which is obviously has some very questionable elements, it also still has that feel of a 1930s, and again, also of its time and no longer acceptable, but they almost feel like a Charlie Chan movie.
Yes.
They're just, what I mean? It's a basic premise, all a whodunit. It's pretty clear who the bad guy is from the jump. And then they add, of course, to make it quote unquote exotic. Well, these are the killers of Kurdistan. I mean, that's very pulpy. And it gives a certain panache by doing so, at the same time that you have to recognize that not cool.
So the next strip is Buck Marshall, Range Detective,
Oh my God.
by Homer Fleming. And this one is curious in that it is done in monochrome, in that it is black and white and basically shades of magenta and pink, which I don't know why it was done this way. I don't know what the point of it was. It's not visually unappealing, and it certainly sticks out. It's just kind of curious. Now, again, much like Speed Saunders, it's way too dialogue heavy. I mean, there are giant
Tons.
word balloons that are just like, oh my God, so, cut this down a little. But, so it's again for a ostensibly a Western strip, it's light on action and heavy on guys in rooms talking to each other.
Yeah, it's a lot of exposition. I do like his name is Buck Marshall, Range Detective. It's loosens his six gun in its holster as he wears the wrap tattoo on pony hooves on Stonewall. Sorry. But it is all people talking, and it's all talk and no show.
Yep.
You get a couple of panels of some violence, and let's face it, that's what you want out of a comic book of this genre. So yeah, I think this is one of the lesser interesting ones. This one was a little bit more of a chore to get through. I kind of like the monochrome. I don't know why they did that. What, you know, I have no idea. There's another story later in the book that does the same thing, but there's not much that recommends it, I would say.
Yeah. So next up is Spy by a team you all may have heard of, Siegel and Schuster. Yes. So these guys had their hands in the two most important comic books in the history of the medium, you could argue.
And it also shows you. It also shows you why they, you know, comparatively with what they had going on with, you know, with Superman, Spy is another one that it's got a couple of moments, but it also kind of defies a lot of logic. You know, this whole thing with a poisoned banana, and the idea that how they try to determine whether it's poisoned is by looking at it, and then. Anyway, and then the other part of it is not only with the poison bananas, but there's the two guys, you know, Bart Regan, Spy, calls the two guys he's trying to protect, and he says, "Don't eat anything. You know, it could be poison." And one of them is like, "Nobody's going to tell me when to eat." I'm like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You're in protective custody, and the guy who's keeping you alive says, "Don't eat what's given to you." And I hate to use the term juvenile, but it doesn't hold together.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just fun seeing their names. You know, I have to say, yeah. I had forgotten that they're in this book, and you're like, oh my God, these guys, yeah. You know, like they just, yeah, right. They were there at ground zero in so many ways. I mean, God, do they have a story in the back of Amazing Fantasy 15 as well? I mean, yeah, right. they're like Zelig. I mean, they're just everywhere in this thing. It's just unbelievable. And it's cool that the one guy kind of looks like Superman too, which is fun.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So next up is the Crimson Avenger. Hey, we have another costumed superhero. This is by Jim Chambers. And it's kind of funny. This is not the, for anyone who doesn't know, this is not the Crimson Avengers' first appearance. He actually predates Batman. And he is a, you know, now he's kind of, yeah, he's a superhero, sort of. He's got a domino mask, but he is just wearing sort of a cape, and he's got these guns and a hat. So he's a little Zorro-y. Later on, he would don a costume and become much more. Yeah, he's very shadowy. It's kind of funny to think that, you know, the way this works, like the Crimson Avenger is sort of like, hey guys, I was right here, you know, like I was like, you wanted superheroes, I'm here, like what do you need this other guy for? And here comes Batman and just dominates the title and pushes Crimson Avenger out of the book into mostly comics obscurity.
Well, wasn't it, I think it was the 80s revival of Secret Origins, where the idea, Roy Thomas's original idea, was to do the comic in a way that it actually introduced the characters in the order that, in which they were introduced in DC. So I think, and your listeners can correct me because I'm not in a position to look it up, but I think that Secret Origins number 2 was a Crimson Avenger story, and they printed that before they printed the Batman story, which came a few issues later, and I think I'm guessing that the sales probably tanked. So they said, I think we're going to have to change the format here, because we can't, you know, we can't afford to have Crimson Avenger tank our sales of what could be a great comic. And as it turned out, it was a great comic and deserves an omnibus, DC.
Yes. Great series. Say that, yes.
Yeah. Secret Origins should be a the whole thing. If you go back to the original 60s, 70s, 80s, should be a thing.
But one of the best shows on the Fire and Water Network was Ryan Daly's Secret Origins show that examined that series, because that series was just great. But that, I love how completely intractable Roy Thomas was about that stuff. I love that, and he had the muscle to kind of get it done.
Right, the world needs Roy Thomas's. You know,
I love it. It really does.
Our entire fandom is based on people. You know, Roy Thomas. You know. Roy Thomas, I think, unfairly gets ripped because he was loyal to Stan Lee, and I think that's so incredibly ridiculous. Roy Thomas is one of the giants, and not
No,
just in terms
absolutely.
of what he, not only in terms of what he did on the page, but in building the concept of comic book fandom,
Yes. Oh,
and being a
sure.
walking encyclopedia, and giving us alter ego. You know, I mean, just so much of it. But anyway,
I just love that idea though of like to, sales be damned. We're going in the order these
We're going
were
to put the Crimson
released.
Avenger. I think it had Gene Colan cover, though. It was really
It's a
cool.
beautiful book. It's a beautiful book. I mean, I bought every issue of Secret Origin, so it didn't matter to me. But I love that they were going to do that, and they somehow the higher ups were like, "All right, okay, like, all right, we'll do it." It's perfectly. It's a strip. It's perfectly fine. It's not terribly, remarkable. Other than he's another costumed superhero, so he sort of jumps out a little. I'm like, okay, in the middle of these cowboys and stuff, we got another superhero.
It adds style to the book for sure.
Next up is a two-page text feature called Death on the Airways by Paul Dean. Old comics all the way up into the 60s featured these things. And I always figure, I never knew why. I always have to assume it was to observe the regulations of like postal things, right? Because they had a certain had to have a certain amount of this kind of material.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It had to do with postal rates. So they always included these as part of it so that I think they could get a certain media, some kind of media mail way of charging their, for, I mean, they used to ship these things in trucks and what have you, like they do now. But I think for anything that would go in the mail, it would be a lot cheaper for them to do it that way. So they always had those prose stories, and I hardly ever read them because I'm
Right,
lazy.
at the risk of revealing too much about my previous younger life, when I was a teenager, I had teenage friends, of course, and did some of those friends have adult magazines? Yes, they did, and
Yes, of course.
one of them was a hardcore magazine, not Playboy, a actually hardcore pornographic magazine. And it was, explicit stuff, except they like every issue, there were like 3 pages talking about like military hardware. And I remembered even as a
Of
kid
course.
looking through
Of
these
course.
going, why is there an article on warplanes in the middle of this feature about these two girls that got drunk? And I'm like, now I look years later, I realize, oh, it was because they were observing some postal regulation thing. But it always flummoxed me. I was like, what?
I also like that they went for the most testosterone-driven,
Yes. Yes.
it's it wasn't about how to tie your necktie. It's about
No.
warplanes,
Yeah. It was,
sexy
yeah. Yep. Yep.
warplanes.
Yep. 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 It always confused me. So, okay. next up is Bruce Nelson by Tom Hickey. I gotta say, even though this thing is 6 pages, 7 pages, I could barely get through it. It was so painfully dull. I'm sorry. This was just the only thing that kept it interesting was the introduction of there's this part where they go to this sort of like temple, and there is a statue with a bat fixture on its head. And I'm like, that's kind of interesting. And then you go to the bottom panel, and the artist, again, Tom Hickey, does a reverse shot behind the bat of these two men that are talking. And so their heads are partly obscured by this bat symbol. But you're like, wow, right there is
They're doing it again.
they're doing it again. And in this other strip.
It's almost like I think the editor was like, who's Vince Sullivan, I think. I mean,
I think so.
Vince Sullivan was the editor. It's almost as if he said, "Guys, liven it up. Throw a fucking bat on there."
Yep.
And
Yeah.
I like this a little bit more than you did, simply because of the, again, the pulpy aspects of it. With the snakes and the bats, and although and for some reason they feel compelled to make it in New Orleans. So, and they're surprised that there's talk of voodoo in New Orleans, which of course New Orleans has a history of whatever. But the Creole trunk that he finds, where he says it's got Creole words, and it's Allah Hickey Dubi Rolk Akma. And I'm going to tell you right now, I don't think that's Creole. I don't think it's close to Creole. I'd be willing to wager anything without even having to research it that that is not Creole. It also is a to be continued.
Yes. Yes. They're assuming that you were so compelled by Bruce Nelson that you would go and buy Detective Number 28 based on that alone. I guess I should be fair. The story itself was okay. It's no worse or better than the others, but I find Bruce Nelson, like the character as his name, so boring that it just reads as like Bruce Nelson. Like, right. Really? At least Buck Marshall sounds like a Western guy. Speed Saunders. Okay, but Bruce Nelson. I mean, it's like, for all your insurance needs, Bruce Nelson, relocations. You know, I mean, it's just like, really? Come up with a, give him some sort of name. I mean, you know, come on.
Insurance needs. Exactly.
It's what true. Is that? Bruce, I mean, really? Bruce Nelson?
Yeah.
Come on.
Burke, huge, large.
Yeah, give him something. Yeah, come on.
Dash Riprock.
Yeah, Dash, exactly. So, yeah, Bob, yeah, Sledge Riprock, exactly. We're dipping into our Mystery Science Theater fandom. Yeah, so, okay, right. Next up is a little bit of a different change of pace. There's the mysterious Dr. Fu Manchu, and it's written by Sax Rohmer. Now, yes, I mean, Sax Rohmer, of course, did not actually literally write this for Detective Comics. This is just an adaptation of one of his Fu Manchu stories, and the text is just typed right there at the bottom of the panels. They're drawn by Leo E. O'Melia, and as you were mentioning earlier, Dan, I mean, the Fu Manchu stuff, there's a reason why like Fu Manchu wasn't in Shang-Chi movie, because it's a racist stereotype that just has not aged with us. I mean, they are, you know, the characters in this are painted yellow, and they are as you know, they are as everything as you would have imagined. So doesn't hold up super well.
It's even worse than you imagine, because of course when you think of Fu Manchu, or at least, you know, the classic image of him is is an Asian man with the long mustache and the beard, and you know, and of course, like you said, all of the tropes are racist and certainly of their time and have no place today. But here it's even worse, because he's drawn here like he's subhuman.
Yeah,
I mean, he looks like a goblin. I mean, it's like he is not even a human being. So he's got like a weird snarling face, and he's a hunchback, and it's grotesque.
Yeah, yeah. And you think about the, like, you know, this is the Batman movie serial, right? Just 4 years after this features
Dr. Daka.
Dr. Daka, a racist stereotype, but that was during post Pearl Harbor. Again, not that makes it acceptable, but that does give you added context to, okay, the country was in this very jingoistic kind of thing. This is before any of that.
Yeah.
Not that America became, you know, all of a sudden that became, racist towards Asians in 1942. Right. But it's just kind of amazing to think that this was already in place long before anything like that.
It's not only in place, but if you go to the next story, Cosmo the Phantom of Disguised, illustrated by Sven Elvin, or Elven, if you believe that accent there, which leads me to believe that is a pseudonym. This is unbelievably racist. This is like I'm reading through this and the way that they have the Chinese people talking to each other is every stereotype you've ever seen. It is interesting looking because it's got the pink and white, or the magenta and black and white. But like, I'm reading this and I'm just groaning the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that at no point, kind of like later on when Warner Brothers would do like the full Warner Brothers cartoons releases, and they would do those little intros saying, you know, some of this stuff, you know, was a product of its time, and we're presenting it, for historical accuracy. There's none of that here. I mean, the Carmen Infantino doesn't spend any time saying, hey, you know, some of this stuff, doesn't really hold up super well. And unfortunately, Cosmo ran for a while. It wasn't like it was one or two. He runs at least like a full six, seven issues. Now, eventually they get rid of him. But I mean, it wasn't like, Actually, it's interesting. I'm looking at it here. He disappears the first issue that Robin shows up. If he's gone after that, so last little long, but yeah, rough visually and rough story wise. And then there's a humor strip, Plain Clothes Pete, by Alger, which again, you know, we can, is a detective Russell Alger Cole, by the way, is actually the full name. You know, it's kind of fun, just as a change up of that. Okay, it's amid all the murder and the crime. There's a fun strip. We can do detectives with humor too. So it's I didn't love it, but it was a fun change of pace.
Yeah. And there are one or two other humor strips in the book that we've kind of
like one page things
like one pagers, but this one is actually a I mean, relatively speaking, a full length story. I don't know, it's a 5-page, 6-page, whatever it is, but yeah, it's drawn in a humorous style, it's done in a humorous style. So then we get to, of course, the climax of the comic. If Batman, of course, is the one that, you know, is the highlight, at least we also get to end on Slam Bradley.
There you go. See, now that's the name, Slam Bradley, Bruce Nelson, right. Slam Bradley. It sounds very exciting. And this is also by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Yes.
And look, I mean, I don't know whether I am like kind of retrograding this because I know that so much has been done with Slam Bradley. Since, right. You know, Darwin Cook did a lot with him. And he's been turned into a genuine sort of fixture of the DC universe. But I would say this was the second best strip in the book. It's got a lot of action to it. You know, it's got a lot of zip to it.
Yeah. I first off, again, Joe Shuster is drawing Slam Bradley to look just like Superman.
Yep.
Right down to the spit curl, I have to say. What I never realized is that Slam had a dopey buddy. I never realized that he had a dopey buddy sidekick, you know, for you know, a comic relief. But yeah, it's good. It's got some good, you know, the scenes on the mountain. You know, there's some interesting artistic flourishes. But I think that this and I did like the Crimson Avenger, but yeah, I think that all things considered, this was I think it's perfectly fine for being a comic story. You could see why Slam Bradley had a little bit of staying power. And, you know, of course, what's been done with him in modern times, basically he's Philip Marlowe. And you don't really get that feel here. He doesn't really have that kind of hard bitten noir thing. But, you know, he's the characters are interesting, and he flies around the world, he solves mysteries, you know. Yeah, it's good stuff.
And the setting is unusual, because you mentioned, like, it takes place on, the second half of the story takes place on a mountain, you know. Yeah. Like, that's just an unusual setting for a detective story. You don't normally think of that as a place for those things. You know, it ends the book on a high note. On the inside back cover, there's an ad for All American Comics and Movie Comics, which was a series that DC did. This is something, I know this will never happen because nobody cares. And the rights would probably even be complicated. I would really kill for a hardcover collection of the Movie Comics book, because I would just love to know what the combination of movies and early comics were like, and what was thought of as to be promoted in the world of comics. You know, I always find that fascinating. So I would love to see the contents of these books. I could never afford any of these. They're from the golden age. They're impossible. So I would love to see these reprinted, but again, I know it's never going to happen because who cares?
No, but it looks like they are adaptation. They're movie adaptations.
Yep.
I mean, you've got Stagecoach and something called Arizona Legion, you know, which was probably the lesser feature, the B feature. You do get a Saint story out of the deal, George Sanders. We actually, you know what we didn't mention, with inside the front cover is one of those, I love these kind of things. You know, it was most famously Flash Facts, where Julie Schwartz and Gardner Fox would always like have a page of like interesting things. There's inside the front covers, Crime Never Pays.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like 5 or 6 different things about like, you know, crime investigation techniques. And my favorite was something I never heard of, which was the police headquarters on wheels. It was an automobile trailer that basically the cops in Nassau County, New York used. So it was basically a combination. You had the police car, but a trailer that had an interrogation room and a crime lab. And that's like, that's very Batman. So, ahead of the times there, Nassau County police.
You learn a lot in this comic.
You sure do.
And then the back cover of the Treasury is a monochromatic shot of Batman as drawn by, I believe that's Infantino and
It's
Murphy Anderson.
Infantino, yeah,
Right. Yeah.
Infantino and Anderson.
That classic pose of him with his hand on him. It's kind of fun to think that how much they use this, because by the time Infantino had drawn this, that was the 60s. So this piece is
It was
already sort of
66.
a little out of date, by this point. They had kind of moved Batman into the more mysterious Avenger of the Night thing. So it's not that, but it's also not Golden Age Batman. It's kind of the 60s Batman, even though this book was published in 74, reprinting a comic from 1939.
Yeah, and that image was used on a lot of merchandise. It was used as as a corner image, I think, on certain Batman comics. It definitely was a known image. And there's also the Batman Treasury, where this image is used as
The painting,
main
yeah, the
cover
cover, yeah.
by Wally Fax, where he did a painted version of it. Oh, and let's not forget the back cover of the issue itself with the great Johnson Smith ad, with the itching and sneezing powder, and just I just love knowing that all that stuff was there in comics from the very beginning.
I love in the ad on the inside cover, it says, "Please don't send in money for any of these
Yeah.
products.
Yes.
These offers are null and void, you nitwits. Don't send a quarter in for itching powder, because that company is long gone." All right, it's
Well, actually, Johnson Smith was still around in the 70s. I mean,
oh
we
my
used to get my
God,
friend.
you imagine?
My friend Paul Kessin and his sister Nina used to get the catalogs, and we'd be like poring over them at his house. Like, oh, the new Johnson Smith catalog was in. It had X-ray specs and chattering teeth and all these other ridiculous things. But yeah, Johnson Smith was around for a long time. I
I
don't
wonder
think they're
what.
around anymore,
No.
but yeah, I do like the idea. Like, yeah, kids, don't send your money.
Yeah, don't send. Yeah. I wonder what that job was like working for that company, right? It's just a
I know,
warehouse
right?
and just filling in orders with sticky quarters stuck in envelopes and things like that. It's probably amazing. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's Detective 27. It obviously deserves to be a famous first edition because it is one of the seminal comics of all time. And so, I would agree with you, Dan, that Batman number one is a more fun read because it's Batman cover to cover. You've got Joker and Catwoman being introduced. This is a bunch of kind of dodgy features plus 6 pages of Batman. But nevertheless, I mean, I had this one as a kid because it was the first Batman, and what are the chances I'm going to have to read this? But we're not quite done yet, everybody,
No.
because there is another Batman related treasury that has actually just come out within a couple of weeks of this recording, and that is a facsimile edition of limited collector's edition number C51, the Ra's al Ghul saga, which of course Dan and I covered on this very show, like episode three or something
Episode
like
three,
that.
yes.
It
Yep, it was.
features the wraparound cover by Neil Adams, really one of the great images of all time. Isn't it, like you said, it's like your all-time favorite image or
I
something,
would
or close
say
to
that
it?
it is one of the top two Batman images of all time. The other one being the Joker and Batman on Batman 251, and
Oh,
both
then
by Neil Adams.
right.
No surprise there. But this is just an extraordinary a cover, and I have to say that I am really happy that this exists. I am a huge fan of facsimile editions. It is something that we cover as a beat at 13th Dimension.
Right.
We are in the fortunate position that we break a lot of news on the facsimile front between both Marvel and DC. So I, you know, when so you know, very, you know, typically we'll get an advanced look before we publish. And when I first found out that this was coming, of course, I couldn't tell anybody, but I was like, oh my God. This was like, I can't believe they're doing this. The fact that they're doing a reproduction of a Treasury edition. Now they've reprinted some Treasuries in hardcover that are slightly smaller, But this is the first time they've actually done, I mean, just that just goes to show you how successful the facsimile edition programs have been for both companies, that now there are like each company puts out like four a month. But the fact that DC pushed all of its chips into the middle of the table and said, we're doing a Treasury edition, and not only that, we're doing the best looking Treasury edition that's ever been done. And it's not, I mean, you could argue, is it the best Treasury ever? People have different, people love the Superman versus Wonder Woman, Superman
Well,
versus
that's Dick
Muhammad Ali.
Tracy. Come on.
Yeah,
Come on, Dan.
right.
That's
Yeah,
Dick
right.
Tracy.
There's right. Yeah, there's right. And there's, and of course the famous first editions and Batman C-37, which is one of the greats and all of that. But as we talked about it in great detail in episode three, there in the 1970s, at this time, certainly at DC, no story deserved this kind of treatment like this, like the Batman, the original Batman Ra's al Ghul saga, issues 232, 230, 242, 43, and 44. And the reproduction is absolutely beautiful. It is. People are always asking, well, is it the recolored version? Is it the, no, it's the same colors. It is the same issue. It is $15, which is a bargain. That and you can get, if you want, and I did, a foil cover, which to me, I'm not like, I'm not like a speculator. Like some people get foil covers for speculation, but if I see a foil cover where I like, it's usually because I really like the way it looks and that it gives a certain sheen to a comic. And I know a lot of people are against them on principle, whatever. But I did buy the foil edition of this one because to see that Adams wraparound cover with that extra texture and that extra reflective, it's striking. When you open it up, it is the pages are white, but not that glossy paper white.
Yes,
It's
yes.
sort of a it's not quite newsprint. It's
It's like
that
that
it's a
Mando print, that Mando paper, right back from the 80s.
yeah, right, exactly. It's crisper so that the colors pop and the line work is really sharp. So it's a great reproduction, and yet at the same time, it is you. And this is why I love facsimile editions to begin with. Is that facsimile editions, and interestingly, of course, the reason why this is so much fun to cover on an episode where we talk about Detective 27, because the first facsimile editions were famous first edition. They were the exact replica of comics that had come out decades before, only in a different size, a much larger size. Now we have the same thing. In a way, we now it's an embarrassment of riches. You get four Treasury editions every month. They're not Treasury size, of course, but you're getting your hands on original comics that are brand new, that are crisp, that are clean, and that you don't have to worry about if you drop it. And I, as a comic book fan, I am incredibly gratified, satisfied, whateverified about the emergency of the facsimile edition and the fact that DC did this. And I hope it sold well. I imagine that it did, because as you know as well as I do, that when it sells, they do more. And that is my hope. And also, because of the competitive nature of the two companies, it makes me think, gee, wouldn't it be great if they did Marvel Treasury Edition number one, the Spider-Man issue, as a facsimile edition? Or if they, if DC and Marvel are now at least on speaking terms, wouldn't it be great if we got Superman and Spider-Man?
Oh, how has that not been reprinted yet? That is
What
insane to
about
me.
Batman and the Hulk? To get the, and also, wouldn't it be great if they turned X-Men,
Teen
New
Titans.
Teen Titans into a Treasury, which
Oh,
was,
man.
I mean, really, the when you look at something like this, all I see are possibilities, and I think to myself, please let this sell, please let this be appealing. When I walked into my comic shop, Oh Yeah Comics in Harrison, New York, on Saturday, And to see them on the shelf, I kvelled, which is Yiddish for I plotzed, which is Yiddish for I had nachas, which is Yiddish for I felt a lot of joy. Just seeing it right there on the shelf, I'm like, there is one of the greatest publications in the history of comics there on a shelf for any kid to look at and say, geez, what's that? Wow, Dad, can I take a look? Or Ma, can I take a look? And I just love the idea that somebody somewhere bought that off the rack and gave it to their kid, or that the kid asked for it, like, oh, that's a big Batman book. I want to take a look at that. And it just continues. Having this is one of the highlights of my comic collecting of the last few years, for sure.
Wow. So, okay, I have a comment or two about the sales of it, but we'll talk about that in
Yeah,
a
I
second.
kind of ran off at the mouth yet. Sorry about
Yeah,
that.
no, it's all right. It's all right. No, I'm very, look, I bought this book. Look, we could have talked about it without me buying this because I know what I read the book already. I know what it is. But I have for all the hard covers. I buy them because, as you said earlier, they have to sell for that for DC or Marvel to do more of them. So I buy them. I own the hard, I bought the hardcover edition of the Bible for Pete's sakes, which is, clearly the only Bible I'm ever going to own. But I bought that one because I want DC to make more of them. I bought the hardcover Amazing World of Superman, weirdo book, because I want them to do more. So I bought this because I want them to do more of these. I am impressed that the ads are the same ads from the book. It is lit. It really is like a famous first edition that. The DC bullet on the cover is the DC bullet from that time, not the current DC bullet. Now that's on the back cover because they have to have a little piece of copyright. But nevertheless, except for the price, the slight notation on the indicia on the inside front cover, and a little bit on the back, this is an exact duplicate of that treasury, as you said, on slightly better paper, which is great. So it's a beautiful addition. Now, obviously.
I mean, and they even take the, and this is what I also love about DC DC does this more than Marvel does, but in terms of even the price on the cover is in the closest font they could
Yes,
find
yes.
to what was used back in 1977.
Yes. They even have that weird number, that 392177 number, which who the hell knows what that even means? And I'm sure it doesn't mean anything to anybody at this point, but
No.
they put it on there because that's what it was on the original. So, okay, now my attitude, and I'm sure yours, Dan, would be I want them to do whatever sells best. If the
Yes.
hardcovers on Amazon are selling better than these, then do those. If this is selling, if the facsimile sells better, then do those. Do you think that, like, on the one hand, for this, the pro to the facsimile edition is the price point, right? It's only $14.99 as opposed to the hardcovers that they were putting out, which were like $29.99, $35.99, were pretty pricey. But this book wasn't available on Amazon. You couldn't buy it on Amazon. You couldn't buy it in a bookstore. Because it didn't have like a, it wasn't, it didn't have an ISBN that you could use, although it does have one on the back cover, but it wasn't available on Amazon, which I think cuts its availability a little bit. In your mind, would you rather have them do facsimile editions this way or the hardcovers?
Well, all things being equal, I'd go with the facsimile edition.
Okay.
And it just from a, I mean, here's the other thing. Like you had said before, I buy facsimile editions on principle. I buy them whether I care about the comic or not, whether I actually, in some cases, intend to read the comic or not. It is some, it is it, whether it's from DC or Marvel or other companies, I do it for that reason. I'll spend the $3 or $4 to send them. I'm voting with my dollars.
Yep.
This is, I want more of these. And clearly it has been successful because they've expanded the programs, and now they're doing not just big version, big treasury editions, but all of Secret Wars is being reprinted in order, all 12 issues, a year's worth of Spider-Man Black Suit, Batman Year One, Crisis on Infinite Earths. So the companies are committed to doing this. So all I want to do is encourage more of it. Now, that said, I also don't see why we can't have our cake and eat it too, because I would love a treasury edition of this in hardcover. And I had mentioned that back in, back in episode three, where I don't think that one obviates the other. I think you could have it, but I wouldn't want it to be the size that they've done some of these other hardcovers, which have been a little bit smaller. I really would want it to be the exact same, it wouldn't be a facsimile edition, but you could have that high end, I guess you could put it on glossy paper if you were, if you preferred, but I am willing to wager that there is enough interest in this for particularly because they, if they were going to come out, they came out swinging, man. They didn't just put out anything. They picked this particular Treasury edition to do first because they had to know that it was a built-in audience beyond people who like facsimile editions because of the Adam stuff. It's classic. It's got so much going for it. So I'd like to think that it will do well enough for us to get more of these. Would it make a difference between hardcover and this? I don't really know. But, having both would be nice.
Yeah, I do. I enjoyed the permanence of the hardcovers,
sure.
and the fact that they had bonus features, like they had contemporary material that was talking about the book at the time. I found that to be fascinating. But this one here that I have on my desk, this feels like a treasury. It feels like the original book that I bought off the cover. That was really thrilling.
Someone wrote a comment the other day and I just did not have a chance to respond. And if I can find the comment, I'm going to go back and respond, but I'll respond this way. Someone asked, what is the appeal of the facsimile edition? And they meant it seriously. They weren't being sarcastic. They even said, look, I'm not being sarcastic. Like, what is it about this that people like? They seemed kind of mystified by the idea. And it's not just the story, because most of the time, the key story that is being featured in whatever facsimile edition you're talking about, whether it's something like this or just your, a comic book, is that you've already read the selling point. It's the experience of reading the comic in its original context.
Yes.
Reading the letters.
Yes.
Now here you don't have letters, you don't have that, whatever. But to me, again, this is all about that presentation, opening it up. And the inside covers are, it's
the text articles.
The text articles and the cover galleries and this and that. Everything is as it was. So it's transportative in a way that a hardcover is not. And the same thing, like people do quibble about the fact that the Golden Age and Silver Age facsimile editions are done in modern, and I'm like done in modern dimensions. And I'm okay with that. I'm like, I understand that you have to give up something to be able to get these things reprinted in an affordable fashion. And I'm okay with reading All American number 14, in modern comic size, so long as everything else is in there. If it's all in there, I'm good with that. And to me, it is that transportative nature, particularly really expensive comics that you'll never be able to own.
Yeah.
And you can never read it this way. Like a really good example is I have a run of Spider-Man that is in the Jerry Conway years. And this is my favorite period for Spider-Man. When I was a kid, I had issue 129, the one with the Punisher. And it got torn apart and it disappeared and what have you. And of course that thing is worth a fortune now.
Yeah.
And there's no way I'd be able to afford a copy. So I got myself a reprint copy. I got myself Marvel Tales, which was kind of expensive actually considering. But then when Marvel, said they were going to do a facsimile edition of it, I'm like, now as far as I'm concerned, that string of issues is now complete. Because I have an exact copy of something that, it's got the ads, it's got Count Dante, it's got, Sea Monkeys, it's got the whole bit.
The most dangerous man alive.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, Count. Side note, Count Dante, I don't understand why Quentin Tarantino hasn't done the movie yet. I really don't. I mean,
he's only making 10 movies. He doesn't.
Yeah, I know that. I guess that's it.
Got limited slots. He's done
his Kill Bill, I guess. Somebody needs to do the Count Dante movie. But to experience all of that in that original context, it's like buying a $4 time capsule.
Yep.
And I am a total sucker for that kind of experience.
Yep. Well, like I said, I was originally going to tell everyone of the incredibly circuitous route it took me to get a copy of this book.
I don't know why that is.
I bored the guys in the Fire and Water thread with it, with the constant updates. Getting, for me, I live in South Jersey. I'm not going to be specific as to where, because I don't want to single out any particular comic shop or shops. I do live in I think, the most populous state in the Union, so you would think getting a copy of this would have been a piece of cake, but it was not. And there was a combination of stores that just didn't order it, or stores that didn't want to order it, or a mixture of also a little bit of incompetence. There was a comic store whose phone number was disconnected, even though they're still in business. I'm just like, how is it this hard to get this book? I'm not asking for an obscure black and white thing,
no,
you know, by an independent publisher. I'm asking for a comic book starring the most popular comic book character probably in the history of the universe, and a book that has a higher price point than most comics, so therefore the store would make more money off it. And it was this combination of nobody wanted to order this thing for me. Nobody.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And the stores that the other stores were kind of like, oh no, we aren't ordering that. And I couldn't wrap my head around it. But and so I ultimately had to go on eBay and buy a copy off somebody who was selling it for cover price, and I paid the extra shipping and they mailed it to me and I got it in a couple of days. But that's what it took. And it was just the kind of thing I want to end the show on a positive note, Dan. But it frustrated me because it says to me, this shouldn't be this hard, because most people are not going to be a complete nerd like me and are going to say, well, I got to get a copy of this because I'm devoted to the Art of Treasuries and I have a podcast about it. I think most people, if you put them through this level of hoops, would just give up. And the fact that this wasn't available on Amazon by itself, that to me made it sort of like, God, I have to go through comic stores to get this. And nobody wants to help me. Nobody wants to help me get a copy.
That's upsetting and worrisome to me about the whole overall sales. Because
yes,
if your experience is being replicated elsewhere across the country, then the message back to DC is that it wasn't worth it.
Yep.
Now, I happen to have an embarrassment of riches. I work in Manhattan. And I live in the New York suburbs, and I, you know, I have many, many choices of great comic book stores near me. The one that I go to is, as I mentioned, All Yeah Comics, which I'd like to single out because they're a great store.
Great store should be singled out. Absolutely.
Great store, All Yeah Comics. Terrific guys run it, and it's a great experience going there. Hi, Mark Hammond, it's not only, you know, I did order mine in advance and I did order multiples because I wanted to, again, support this. And I'm like, you know what? I know that I'm dipping into my wallet a little bit, but in the long run, I hope that this does pay off. I want to support this as much as I can. And you know, I did stories at 13th Dimension, and I actually reposted the link to the podcast that we did. And all of these wonderful things about this issue in hopes of getting people to buy it. Now, I'm glad that the story's trafficked quite well. So hopefully that is, because I do know that a lot of times when certain stories traffic well, it does translate, because I'm able to track certain things, it does translate into sales. Not that we would be the difference maker for something like this. I'm not that kind of, you know, I'm not that arrogant. But I am hopeful that given the response that I got in terms of the number of people who read the story or stories, that enough of them went out and bought it, and enough of them went out and bought it and made it so that DC saw something. And hopefully it offsets kind of the nonsense that you're talking about. Because frankly, I don't understand any place, any comic book store, or any store, that if they are able to order you something, that they would not want to order it. It's one thing if they don't do it on, you know, they don't order it because they don't think anybody's going to buy it. But if someone walks in the door and says, here is my money, I would like to give it to you. If I give it to you, will you fill out a small form and order this? And so it will come in with all of the other comic books it would come in with, no skin off your nose. You don't have to find rack space for it. You don't have to find a way to store it. If you order it, what's the harm? And that's very, very disappointing to hear. And like you said, I don't want to end on a low note, but I'm just hopeful that your experience was not the norm, and that there was more enthusiasm out there for it, because I want more of these.
It, yes, it seemed like I said, I was bothered. I was boring the guys in the fire and water thread with it, and none of them seemed to have the problem. They all seemed to be able to. Chris Franklin talked about he went into his store and got it, and Paul Ken talked about it and he got it. I seemed to be unique, and it was driving me insane because I just this is one of those things where, yeah, no, I really wanted to end positively, but now I'm all worked up about this because it was like it was just one of these things where you know something where. It's kind of like when you know, anyone in any day, you know, any walk of life, like you go and you devote some time to what you think was going to be an incredibly easy little project, and it flypapers into something where you're like, oh my God, I've now spent 2.5 hours on this. How did this, you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. Like, oh, I just thought I'd paint this wall, and now I've dropped the paint can, and now you know what I mean? Like that, and you're mad at yourself that this thing has metastasized into a project of death.
You're like,
And
I don't have time for this.
exactly, I never would have started it. And you know, look, and there was this again, I'm not going to name any stores, but the store that I used to shop at as a kid in the 80s and 90s, that was a great store, a great, and it was really the building block of my fandom of comics. That store has gone down. It's still around, but that store has gone downhill. And in the 2000s, there was a bunch of times where there would be some special book, and I would call. And I would say, can you order this for me? And they would say, yes. And I would come in the day it was supposed to come out. And they would say, oh, it didn't come in. Not, oh, it didn't come in. I'm really sorry. It'll be in on this date. Or I'm really sorry it didn't come in. I don't know why it didn't come in, but I'll call you. It was met with, no, it didn't come in. Like just utter indifference. And after about five of those, I gave up going to that store. Partly because, as I mentioned earlier, this is my last show before we're leaving New Jersey. And we only had a very tight window of time to record, to get this book, read it, kind of think of, have time to think about it, and record this. So I didn't have a lot of time to dick around. But it was like every store just completely met, I was met with utter resistance. And it just was like, this is a $15 Batman comic. Why is this so hard? And I think about other modes of entertainment. Does that ever happen to you? Have you ever gone to a movie theater expecting to see Dune Part Two? And the theater goes, oh no, we didn't get Dune. Sorry. No, that's never happened to you. That's never happened in the history of movie going. Why? Because they know that person will never come back to that theater. But comic book stores are just like, meh, meh.
Comic book store. That's why I treasure having good ones, because
That and
it's
yes.
like I don't ever feel like I you cannot take a good comic book store for granted.
No.
You absolutely cannot, because there are so many crappy ones out there that and it's because it basically they're the it, particularly if they're the only game in town and
Yes.
the only game in for miles around.
Yep.
And a lot of people don't want to get their comics in the mail. They want to be this and that and the other thing, and so they're kind of stuck with the classic Simpsons character. But that's the things like the upshot, folks, is that if you have yourself a good comic book store, go into your store this weekend or this coming Wednesday or whatever, and just salute the person behind the counter, because it is such a joyful thing to do, is to go. I look forward every week. I can't go on Wednesdays because I don't have the time to be able to do it and get back before they close. But I almost every Saturday make a visit to Aw Yeah and take some time to chat, and I've met friends there, and I've done, it's wonderful. So let's end it on that positive note and salute the good comic
Absolutely.
book
That's a
stores
great
out there.
place
There
to
you
end.
go.
I am thrilled this book exists. I'm so happy DC did it. They did it right, and I hope they do more of them. And as you said, I hope Marvel gets in on this as well. I would
Yeah,
love
me either.
nothing more than a whole megillah of Treasury facsimile editions. I would buy every single one of them, no matter which one they did. I'll
I
even
would
buy
love to
Superman and
see.
Hulk go to the Winter Olympics. It doesn't matter. I'll get it because I want these to exist again. That would be great.
I, even if they did the comics, I mean, not to get too far away from it, but even the comics that should have been done. like Green Lantern number one as a famous first edition,
oh, that'd be
or
great.
You know what I mean? Like, there are certain issues.
Brave and the Bold number
done.
28, you know, do them, do
yeah,
newer ones.
Yeah, there's so many really, really cool ideas that could be done with this format. And I just hope that we're just scratching the surface, but time will tell.
I hope so. We'll find out. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming back. You've been a regular on this show since we started. And as I mentioned a couple episodes ago, we're winding the show up. So you've run the gamut from the beginning almost to the very end. So thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. And why don't you tell people, as people are listening to this, the show is dropping on Sunday the 31st, but tell everybody about what's been going on at 13th Dimension, just as it's wrapping up on the site as your people listening to this, but what you've been doing for the last couple of weeks.
We have, it's been a while since we've done a theme week, and with Batman's 85th anniversary, it's just not something I could pass up. And we have so many great contributors that I just basically put out a call and said, guys, you know, who wants to write something? And so we've had a full week of Batman coverage in addition to some of our other regular coverage. And it's some different stuff that we've, you know, sometimes with a theme week, I'll rerun certain stories or go back, and this is all new material, and it's some, you know, all new, all different. and it's just a lot of really, really great stuff. There are a couple of columns that were actually from other projects, like Jeanette Kahn's introduction to the DC 85 book. We got permission to reprint that. So there's ostensibly a column there from Jeanette Kahn, an interview that Paul Kupperberg had done with Jerry Robinson, and we excerpted that. So that, and it's about how Jerry Robinson basically met Bob Kane, which was playing tennis. And so it's just an interesting story of how he got involved. But a lot of the other stuff that we're doing, Chris Franklin, who's a regular at the site, Chris does a lot of, when we do these theme weeks, he does a lot of the times. He'll do something about action figures or merchandise. And he did a wonderful piece on the top 13 first appearance Batman action figures, which there are actually enough of them to do that. And he even went so far as to Photoshop some of them into Detective 27.
Fantastic.
So yeah, like the cover of Detective 27 is the Hasbro Detective 27 Batman, photoshopped flawlessly into the cover. And it's like, as soon as I saw that, I about fell off my chair. Also, by the time you've heard this, you know, Walt Grogan, who does a lot of stuff for us as well, he rated the top 13 Detective Comics logos of all time. Your own bad self, had something that we've run, your latest Real Retro Cinema column, which, like, as you pointed out, when we were talking off air, didn't even realize you've written more than 100 of these over the lifespan of the website. And this one is about Batman Returns, which I can't believe we've never done yet.
I know.
One of our columnists is Pete Stone, who is Neil Adams' son-in-law, and he's a regular at the site, and he's got two columns that he runs with us. One is the Neil Adams Chronicles, where he routinely will write about Neil and about Neil's points of views on certain things, and often about other artists. And it's really, really interesting stuff because, you know, Pete worked with Neil and worked for Neil and spent all day with Neil. So he's got this great insight about what made Neil tick. And so he wrote a piece. Of course, you know, you can't have a Batman week without talking about, Neil Adams' Batman. So we've got that in there. And Peter Bosch, one of our guys, he writes a lot about the Silver Age. It also happened to be this week the 60th anniversary of the new look Batman from 1964. So this was an absolute joy this week. We had a tons of we kicked off a new feature, Morrison Mondays, with cartoonist Bill Morrison, where he did a basically a mock-up of if Jack Kirby were working for DC back in the day. He did a JLA cover that basically is an homage / parody of Avengers number 4 with Batman in the middle of it. Kerry Callan, another one of our contributors, the cartoonist, did this hilarious piece about Batman's overly long cape. So there's I'm probably missing a few things. But this coming out on that Sunday is an epilogue to the coverage, because the 30th is the actual day of the anniversary of 27. This show comes out on the 31st. So we're wrapping up our coverage with a post about this podcast. So listen, folks, we had a ton of fun doing it. For those of you who've read some of the material and who are listening, you know, I appreciate you showing up. The response has been tremendous. And if you haven't checked it out, I invite you to do so, because I think you'll find something. Look at it. If you've made it all the way through this podcast, I'd say that the chances are 99 out of 100 that you're going to find something that you're going to want to read at the site this week. So you are more than welcome to join the party.
Absolutely. There's a ton of great stuff. And I will just say, just speaking as a fellow member of the Fire and Water Network, Fire and Water Podcast Network, nobody does Toy Talk better than Chris Franklin. The man knows his stuff backwards and forwards. He'll share little bits and pieces with us before he sends it off to you, before it gets published. And it's just like, oh my God, this is so cool. So we've been bugging Chris to do a toy related podcast on the network for years, because he just knows this stuff and speaks about it so joyfully and eloquently. And so anytime he writes something for 13D on toys, it's just, that's a total must read.
Yeah. Same thing. I love reading when they come in. I love reading them because it's, I learn stuff too. I mean, it's not only entertaining and like you said, joyous or joyful, but it's there's stuff that I'm like, oh yeah, I didn't know that. And sometimes he'll cost me money. I'm like, damn, Chris, you just cost me $50. A good $50 well spent.
So, well, again, Dan, thanks so much for coming back. I really appreciate it. And,
thank you as always. I really appreciate it. I love coming here. I wish I could do it more often. And I also congratulate you on the finale of Pod Dylan. I know that was a labor of love for you.
Thank you.
I'm honored to be your last New Jersey podcast. And I wish you well in your travels, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Absolutely. We will be podcasting again once I am ensconced in our new location at some point. Absolutely. So, and thank you all for listening. As Dan said, if you got to this point, you'll definitely want to be checking out all the stuff at 13dimension.com. So stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, Sean, did you know that Batman Family Reunion is expanding?
Oh my God, what? Our episodes are now going to be 3 hours long?
No, no, no. Now that we have moved into Detective Comics, we are going to see stories starring other members of the, let's say, extended Batman family, like the Human Target.
Well, he's a detective.
The Demon.
He's been in Batman Family before.
Elongated Man.
He's a detective.
Red Tornado.
He's been in Batman Family before.
Black Lightning.
Ooh, he's cool.
And the Atom.
He's small. I'm excited by the upcoming artists. Not only are we still going to see my favorite, Michael Glorious Golden, but we will see art by Don Newton, Dick Giordano, Irv Novik, Jose Delbo, Johnny Craig, and even Steve Ditko and Dan Spiegel.
Awesome, but we won't forget the original stars. We'll see Robin return to the big top and Babs discover a family secret. Man-Bat teams up with Jason Bard, Batman teams up with Batgirl, and we will finally get an all-new Alfred story. We will see villains like Maxi Zeus, the Riddler, the Crime Doctor, and the Truckers.
But Paul, you know people say that the best part about the reunion is getting to interact with our Bat cousins. I personally think it's all of the food, but I understand their point of view. We are continuing our guest list, including some repeat visits, but also some new Bat relatives. We love that our show has become a real family reunion, and we can't wait for you to hear what we have planned. That's the Batman Family Reunion on all of your podcast apps, only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, like Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. So check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old.
And it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on the previous episode of Treasury Cast, number 89, where we talked about Tarzan with my guest Chad, a.k.a. Comic Foil. First up is Chad, who says, wanted to take this moment to thank Rob again for having me on the show, and I swear I didn't have a cold. I can only chalk up the nasally sound of my voice to my need to invest in a better microphone. Being on Treasury Cast was quite a fun experience, and the time flew by. One thing that hit me, listening back to our discussion, was in regard to DC not doing another Tarzan collection, probably had more to do with Tarzan of the Apes and the return of Tarzan both being direct adaptations of ERB novels, whereas the rest of the Tarzan comic series were original stories or reprints. I would have loved it if Kubert could have done more adaptations, and then maybe DC would have published more Tarzan treasuries, but alas, it was not to be. One last thing, I want to warn the listeners of Treasure Cast not to turn this episode into a drinking game, consuming every time they hear me say pop or 100%. No one needs to get alcohol poisoning. And if I do another podcast, I'll make sure to have a list of synonyms handy for both. Chad, don't worry. You did a great job. And please don't worry about using the same phrase over and over again. I say, you know, so many times in any given podcast. And for every one that you hear on this show, I edit out five more. So, and I've been doing this for 12 years now. So, no worries. You did a great job, especially for being your first podcast, as these other comments will indicate. Edo Boznar says, excellent show yet again. Chad in particular was an interesting guest, precisely because he has such a newbie perspective on Tarzan, unlike so many of us old hands who read the novels and many of the comics, et cetera, before we hit our teens. I'll just say to Chad, though, that if you're anything like me, you get a bit tired of Burroughs' original novels long before you hit volume 24. I threw in the towel at number 15. Otherwise, not to repeat too many of my comments from the previous episode covering the other Tarzan treasury, I'll just reiterate once again that, yes, Legend of Tarzan with Sarsgaard and Robbie is probably my favorite ever Tarzan movie. But, yes, it probably didn't make a bigger splash just because the Tarzan property has finally started to lose its luster among successive generations. It had a pretty good, basically century-long run, though. As to Kubert's art, no arguments from me about how wonderful it is. And I'll just add that I also think he drew women quite well, even if he probably never topped anyone's list as a good girl artist. I'll conclude by saying thanks, Rob, for including the title sequence audio from the Filmation cartoon at the end of the episode. What an amazing rush of nostalgia that gave me, especially since that cartoon was what sparked my interest in all things Tarzan that lasted for a few years. You're welcome, Ado. Super Captain says, I enjoyed Tarzan quite a bit in my younger years, but strangely enough, not in comics form. Local TV stations showed several old black and white film versions, which probably caught my eye because of Cheetah. Even at a young age, I was a sucker for a simian. The Filmation cartoon from the 70s was my Tarzan, as voiced by Thundar himself, Robert Ridgely. And of course, every kid tried out our vocal cords on the Tarzan yell. Nice show that led me to reminisce a little, and Chad, always good to hear from another fan residing in the old North State. Rocky Starwin says, great episode. There was a second Disney Tarzan, I think it was straight to video, and a Tarzan animated series. It's news to me. And a prequel movie, I think. Does anyone remember Disney Extreme Skate Adventure? I mentioned it because you could play the Tarzan characters in there, including Jane and Tarzan. I didn't know any of that, Rocky. Paul Kahn from this very network says, great episode, guys. Never been a huge Tarzan fan, but I did have some giant-sized Tarzan family comics back in the day, naturally. I agree that the art is fantastic. Your pal Joe must have really enjoyed drawing it. Siskoid, also from the network, says, great Kubert Tarzan content, two great tastes that go well together. Agreed. Dr. Ann says, great episode. Always love to hear new guests. Tarzan has always been on the periphery of my fandoms. I love the CBS cartoon, often teamed with the Lone Ranger or Batman. I like Appointment Sunday morning cartoon. I dabbled in the old movies shown on Saturdays on Channel 38 here in the Boston area, but I never read Tarzan comics, and I've never read the novels. Nothing against it, just never went there. Seeing these pages makes me think I need to reconsider. That's centerfold. Amazing. Alas, recently a brick of these Tarzan books were in the dollar box on my local LCS recently, bagged and boarded no less, and I didn't buy. They are now gone. Lastly, I think the Bo Derek Tarzan movie does hold up depending on the reason you were watching it. For Tarzan, no. For other reasons, perhaps. Yeah, that's accurate, Ange. Of course, Chris Franklin from this network says, fun episode, and Chad was a podcasting natural. Kubert's Tarzan always seemed to be the most visceral and primal of everyone who drew him. Most before or after gave him somewhat of a polished sheen, but Kubert brought the savage side to the visuals, even though his Tarzan was well-educated like the Burroughs version. I feel like this diorama is a bit more achievable than most. The lines around Tarzan are pretty thick. You probably still need sharp scissors and an X-Acto knife, but I bet it could be done. Well, you can go try it, Chris. Gene Papa says, Rob, you may just have to tack on an extra episode next year. Big Bang Comics is releasing their very own Treasury Edition, and he provided a link. So that's fun. I'm always happy that there are new treasuries out there. I don't think I'm going to extend the show just for it, but I'm very excited that they're going to do it. And if they publish it, it really does come out, I will absolutely buy it. As we mentioned with Dan, I will buy any new treasury that somebody makes because they want them to keep going. Chuck Coletta says, FYI, a nice new Blu-ray of Tarzan the Ape-Man from 1932 was recently released. I just watched it tonight, and it's clear to see why The Lord of the Jungle has been iconic for more than a century. I've been picking up some of the recent miniseries featuring Tarzan. A favorite is the Tarzan Planet of the Apes mashup. That's a natural mix. Thanks for another fun episode. Well, thank you, Chuck. And then finally, Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Chad. By the way, Rob and Chad sounds like one of those beach bands playing in the background of an Annette Funicello movie. I was never a big Tarzan guy. I think as a kid, it always bugged me that he was supposed to be this friend of the jungle, but was always stabbing an ape or lion on every book cover. Jungle animals talk, Tarzan. Eventually, they'll figure out you are the problem. The Kubert art is terrific, though. He was DC's Buscema, born to draw on the non-superhero titles. Did you know he had a school? I'm guessing the basketball team isn't very good. Well, solid show. Sorry to hear that this is the last year of Treasure Cast, but as the saying goes, always best to end on a round number. Thank you, Brett. You're always full of wisdom. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for the feedback. I really do appreciate it. Big thanks to Dan Greenfield for coming back and talking about two Batman treasuries with me. That's why the show ran a little long, but of course, that's okay. Like I said, really happy DC did this limited edition facsimile book. I hope they do more of them. And despite it was the difficulty I had getting it, I'm hoping when I move to my new environs, I will find a good local comic shop. And if I do, I will certainly let you all know about it because, as Dan said, a good store deserves credit. And we should promote the good comic stores because a lot of them are not very good. So I hope I can find a new store that will maybe reinvigorate my interest in the comics medium because it'll be fun to go back into a store and see new things and what's on the shelf and things like that. And maybe if they do more of these facsimile treasuries, I'll be able to get it a lot more easily. Here's hoping. So that's going to do it. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. You can find the show on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pullier, Brett Young, Mark Bulbus, and Chuck Dill for their support of Treasury Cast. Really appreciate it. Plus, big thanks to Gord Tolton and David S. Gutierrez for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. That is going to do it. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next month. But until then, go big or go home.
High atop one of the hills which ring the teeming metropolis of Gotham City, a large house rears its bulk against the dark sky. Outwardly, there's nothing to distinguish this house from many others. But deep in the cavernous basements of this house, in a chamber hewn from the living rock of the mountain, is the strange, dimly lighted, mysteriously secret Bat's Cave, hidden headquarters of America's number one crime fighter, Batman. Yes, Batman, clad in the somber costume which has struck terror to the heart of many a swaggering denizen of the underworld. Batman, who even now is pondering the plans of a new assault against the forces of crime. A crushing blow against evil in which he will have the valuable aid of his young, two-fisted assistant, Robin the Boy Wonder.